It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, it's Food Friday. We'll talk about some of the foods and the recipes that make us nostalgic.
First.
And so, my friends, it is with humility, determination, and boundless confidence in America's promise that I accept your nomination for President of the United States.
Hillary Clinton became the first woman to receive the nomination of a major political party in the United States at the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia.
And speakers including President Obama and the First Lady, parents of shooting victims, veterans, all came out to the convention to endorse Hillary Clinton for president. But some Democratic delegates are still not completely on board with Clinton just yet, as some Bernie Sanders supporters protested during the convention.
We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What was your biggest takeaway from this week's convention? What do you want to see during the general election? What do you want to learn about Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton or third-party candidates that you don't know yet? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or share your comments, your questions on the Central Time Facebook page.
Lily Gorin is with us now. She's a political science professor at Carroll University. She was with us last week to recap the Republican National Convention and is back with us now for a look at the Democratic National Convention now that that's wrapped up. Lily, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on again.
Well, in terms of how well it was pulled off, how well messages were delivered, how would you rate the Democratic National Convention?
This convention seemed to actually go off fairly well, clearly organized with thematic sort of consistency across the evenings. A lot of, you know, pretty big hitters, as we say, in the speeches that were delivered. And I think in a lot of ways, it was an attempt to present, not only to present, but also to actively unify the party behind the standard bearer now, Hillary Clinton, as well as a lot of the Democrats who are running for office across the states and localities.
And let's talk about that speech by Hillary Clinton last night, high stakes. As far as timing goes, not quite as long as Donald Trump's and not quite as many people watched it. And it's interesting to see the reaction today. Here's a portion.
Some of you are frustrated, even furious. And you know what? You're right. It's not yet working the way it should. Americans are willing to work and work hard. But right now, an awful lot of people feel there is less and less respect for the work they do, and less respect for them, period. Democrats, we are the party of working people. But we haven't done a good enough job showing we get what you're going through, and we're going to do something to help. So tonight I want to tell you how we will empower Americans to live better lives. My primary mission as president will be to create more opportunity and more good jobs with rising wages right here in the United States.
And Lily, that nod at the beginning to being frustrated, maybe even furious, was that, do you think, intended to be a bridge to Bernie Sanders supporters or people considering a vote maybe for Donald Trump?
Yeah, I think that there were certainly that part of the speech and other parts of the speech were designed to open up the sort of discourse or the opportunity if people are looking to consider Hillary Clinton or the Democrats, that this is, you know, how you define how she was defining the Democratic Party and to some degree the role that the Democratic Party has long had with regard to working people, as she said. And so I think that that part was probably more pitched possibly towards Trump voters and to a degree to Sanders voters. There were other parts of the speech that I think were probably more directly connecting to or attempting to connect to Sanders supporters.
And what were those parts of the speech?
Well, I think that some of the other parts of the speech where she does talk specifically about income inequality and does also, it really at the beginning of the speech up front, she does a number of sentences where she talks specifically specifically about Sanders and Sanders' campaign and putting questions of inequality, racial, and as well as income front and center. As she said, I think the quote was, where they belong, and that she credits him and the campaign and the people who work for him with doing that. So to some degree, there were direct shout-outs to a lot of the issues that Sanders had himself campaigned on.
And last night, one question going in was, will there be a noticeable disruption from Bernie Sanders supporters who are still not on board with Hillary Clinton? And that was a thread running through the convention, maybe more so at the beginning. But what is your sense of how big a deal or how prominent that ended up being during the convention as a whole?
Well, as you know, somebody who's watching it at home, I wasn't at the convention itself, but you know, from what I've heard from reporters who were on the scene, that there were, you know, there was a lot of sort of back and forth, particularly on Monday night of the convention, and that a lot of that was also coming specifically from, I guess, the California delegation, but that by the time you got to Thursday night, a lot of the folks who had been making a lot of the noise, or who had been booing, or who had been saying no TPP for the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a lot of that had really been sort of quieted down, at least sort of Wednesday and Thursday night. It was not as prominent as it was on Monday night, although Leon Panetta's speech was one that was clearly interrupted and disturbed by some of the shouts with regard to no war.
We're talking with Lily Gorin right now, political science professor at Carroll University. And we're looking back, taking stock of the Democratic National Convention, which wrapped up last night with an acceptance speech from Hillary Clinton. And one narrative coming out of that speech last night was that the Democrats, from Hillary Clinton to Barack Obama, were sort of seizing a platform of optimism that, yes, there was room for improvement, but that as a whole, America was still great. What did you think of that?
Well, I think if you listen to Barack Obama's speech starting in perhaps 2004, but certainly to a number of his speeches over the years that he's been in the public, a lot of what he's talked about is perfecting this more perfect union, as the Constitution says, and that part of his own narrative and his own experience as an American citizen is one that he often highlights as part of that sort of narrative of optimism and the best days are in front of us, as he's said on a number of occasions, which is something that Ronald Reagan has also often said. And he quoted Reagan's quote about being a shining city on a hill, which comes from, you know, some of the Puritan forebearers who showed up here in the 1600s.
Now, on policy issues, she covered a lot of ground, including the issue of guns.
I'm not here to repeal the Second Amendment. I'm not here to take away your guns. I just don't want you to be shot by someone who shouldn't have a gun in the first place.
So I guess the line that stands out, I'm not here to take away your guns. What do you make of that portion of the speech?
Well, you know, this is an attack line that has been used against her, mostly coming from the right, that Hillary Clinton wants to abolish the Second Amendment. And so I would assume that the reason that was installed in the speech itself and the way she gave it, you know, she did have a sort of interesting rhetorical move that she made there, incorporating the fact that she doesn't want to take away the Second Amendment, that she doesn't want to take away people's guns, but she doesn't want guns in the hands of people who shouldn't have access to them, is about, you know, certain attempts at some control or gun control policy that's being advocated by some of the people who are at the convention earlier, the mothers of the movement. This is something that Michael Bloomberg, who is neither Democrat nor Republican, he is an independent, as he said from the stage in Philadelphia, has poured a lot of his own money into. And so I think to some degree she was trying to make the argument that, or counter an argument that has been one of the ones that has been used against her.
We're talking right now with Lily Gorin, a political science professor at Carroll University, talking about this week's Democratic National Convention.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think of what you saw from Democrats? Are you on board? If you were doubting, never going to be on board with Hillary Clinton, what would she need to do to sell her campaign to you? How about Donald Trump, for that matter? What are you looking at in the road ahead? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can post on the Central Time Facebook page or email talk@WPR.org.
Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our conversation now with Lily Gorin from Carroll University, looking at the Democratic National Convention. It just wrapped up last night in Philadelphia, and looking at the road to November.
And we want to hear from you. What did you think of this week's convention? Are you worried or excited for the general election? You can tell us what you thought at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also leave your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page or email them to talk@WPR.org. And we'll take our first caller now. We have Elizabeth with us in Green Bay. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi. Excuse me. So this election makes my heart hurt a little. When I was a kid back in the 90s when Hillary Clinton was big. And she, as a kid growing up in, you know, a bad environment, really poor, she's one of the first people that inspired me to care about the community and care about the world and the others and helping. And I attribute a lot of the messages I heard her say as a kid to me being in social work and psychology now. Where it gets sad is back during the Obama election when she was running the first time. The more research I did, the more I found out that the ideals that she spoke of, she in her personal life does the opposite. So like her taking money from the poor, using Globe University and others. So now with this election, I've always voted Democrat just because I care about the people, care about the poor, and I can't anymore. So I'm voting Green Party because the Green Party is the closest to my ideals. But it hurts because one of the people that I looked up to so much as a kid is now basically trained me to be against who she actually is.
So nothing, Elizabeth, nothing you heard at the convention from Hillary Clinton or the people there to support her, none of that changed your feelings?
No, and I was really hoping it would, because honestly, I'm sure anyone out there who's ever lost a role model knows that, like, that pain of, like, oh, you're, like, my idol. And no, like, I watched and I listened, but and no, I have my master's now, and I know a lot about what's going on, and it didn't work for me, and it disheartened me a lot. So voting Green Party, knowing that my vote doesn't really matter because of gerrymandering anyways, so there you go.
Elizabeth, thanks so much for that call. Interesting call there from Elizabeth, Lily, talking about how she was inspired and influenced by Hillary Clinton early on. But is not on board with her anymore. And I think Hillary Clinton tried to answer some people similar maybe to Elizabeth, talking about her public service record, saying she wasn't always as good at the public part of it as she was at the service, and address some of those. Was she effective at all, do you think?
Well, I mean, again, for the caller, for Elizabeth, she wasn't effective. She may have been effective for other people. And it was also a number of people who were at the convention on all week who were also making the case for Hillary Clinton. One of the interesting sort of aspects of Hillary Clinton that has been sort of analyzed by some political scientists and also by people in the blogosphere is that she's generally more popular and people like her better when she's not running for office, but she is in some sort of position where she may be serving either as first lady or as, you know, Secretary of State, but when she is actually running for office, that there is a great concern about, you know, who she is and how she conducts herself, and so that there's a disconnect for her, or at least to some degree there may be, with regard to her as a candidate versus her as actually a public servant.
As a political scientist, what do you make of that? What does that tell you?
Well, I think that part of it is, you know, the difficulty that we have in the system that we have, where if you're running for a public office, particularly one of president or for senator, which are statewide offices, you need so much money in in order to sort of, you know, get onto the map and potentially win, that it often looks like you are compromising because of the money that you have to take from lobbyists and from interest groups and so forth. And that's one of the difficulties of running for public office in the United States system. It's a really expensive undertaking. And it often, in fact, clouds people's judgments of you because you do need the money in order to, you know, get anywhere.
Thank you for that call, Elizabeth. Appreciate it. And one more from Dimitri in Milwaukee. Dimitri, hi.
Hi there. Perfect. Yeah, I just wanted to say there was a superdelegate that was up during the DNC who was supporting Bernie and said, frankly, that he doesn't have to make his decision up until November. And I think that's pretty much how a lot of people like myself who are supporting Bernie supporters are feeling, is that we don't necessarily have to say that we're with Hillary. Those that are against Hillary are not against her policies because she's adopted a lot of the progressive Bernie policies. It's the fact that she's not a very trustworthy individual who's flip-flopped on too many policies in the past. So some of us may vote for Gary Johnson, some of us may vote for Jill Stein, or, you know, we might team up and say we can't have Donald Trump in the presidency. So we'll wait until November.
So, Dimitri, you said waiting for November. What are you waiting for? What sorts of things are you going to be looking for during that time?
It's actually not a lot of looking into. It's basically feeling out how close Donald Trump is to a presidency. So if Gary Johnson, for example, doesn't get 15% of the vote in polling and doesn't get onto the national debate stage, then that may swing people like myself to vote for Hillary to avoid a Trump presidency.
Dimitri, thanks a lot for that. And he says he's going to wait till November, find out how close we are to a Trump presidency. Do you think that's something that other folks are saying at this point?
You know, I think folks on both sides of the aisle actually are saying that. I think that there are some people who are not, you know, Republicans who are not really on board with Trump, but they're sort of waiting to see how things are going and you know, what the polls may say over the next 2 to 3 months, what happens in the debates. Possibly we'll have a number of debates that will be coming up in October, and that may be areas where people like Dimitri or people on the other side of the aisle, you know, ultimately start to come down on one side or the other. You know, a vote is a very personal thing for many people, and it's something that many Americans take extremely seriously. And while, you know, there's not just the top of the ticket, there's also votes, you know, as Ted Cruz, up and down the ballot. And those are things that people, you know, consider a lot when they go to vote.
And we're talking with Lily Gorin right now from Carroll University. Lily, let's talk about Khizr Khan took the stage with his wife to talk about their son who was killed in Iraq. And he was a Muslim American army captain. And here is Khizr Khan talking about Donald Trump.
Hillary Clinton was right when she called my son the best of America. If it was up to Donald Trump, he never would have been in America. Donald Trump consistently smears the character of Muslims. He disrespects other minorities, women, judges, even his own party leadership. He vows to build walls and ban us from this country.
And Lily, again, that was one of the more talked about speeches from last night. What do you think people heard in that speech that made it resonate?
Well, you know, I have to tell you, when I heard that, when I was watching it, I think I stopped breathing. I was so moved by Mr. Khan and his story and his delivery, and somebody who keeps her Constitution with her often and always. The fact that he, you know, sort of indicted Mr. Trump in terms of possibly not having read the Constitution and offered to lend it to him, and to some degree stood there as his tribune, of his son and what his son was committed to in the United States as a country and willing to defend it. And they had come from another country where they had been oppressed. It was an incredibly affecting speech.
And we'll go back to our callers now and take a call from Jack in Viola. Jack, hi.
Good afternoon. I really like the convention. I'm a Bernie supporter, okay? But, you know, I look at what Bernie did. He was an outsider, and he moved to an inside strategy. And his integrity, and he knew what he was doing when he did it. And he knew if he lost, he would support Hillary. He knew what the stakes were. And that inspired me about where I'm at. I'm not cynical about the whole thing. I know politics is dirty at times. And, you know, Hillary has played the game, okay? I can find fault with a lot of things. Same thing with Obama. But, on the other hand, I weigh things out, and I like what I heard. I know the party platform is really good. I know a lot of Vernon County Democrats who are Bernie supporters. Matter of fact, there was a county that voted most heavily for Bernie, except for, I think, Portage County.
And, Jack, we're going to leave it there so we can let our guest Lily respond. And Lily, Jack is okay with how things turned out. He understands politics. Looking at the majority of Bernie supporters, do you think Sanders supporters are sharing that sentiment?
Well, from the polls that I've seen, the indication is that there are quite a few Sanders supporters who have said that they will support Hillary Clinton in the general election. Not all. Obviously, we've talked to a couple on the show already. But there are quite a few who are sort of in the mindset of Jack that, you know, they really liked what Sanders was running on, that a lot of it was integrated into the platform, that parts of it, again, made its way into Hillary Clinton's speech, that it was enunciated there, and that, you know, that's also politics. There are winners and losers in politics.
And Lily, just in our last few seconds, now that both conventions are over, what should we be on the lookout for next?
Well, you know, again, we saw Mike Pence was in Waukesha I think on Wednesday, and I'm sure we're actually going to see pretty much all of the candidates, I assume, as well as many of their surrogates in Wisconsin, as we move into the general election season.
Lily, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
That was Lily Gorin, political science professor at Carroll University. And she joined us to talk about this week's Democratic National Convention, just ended last night in Philadelphia.
Coming up after the news, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. We'll talk about foods that make us nostalgic. I'm Rob Ferrick.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, it's our weekly look at state news with Rob Menser from USA Today Network, Wisconsin. This week, we'll talk about a potential $1 billion shortfall in transportation funding in the next budget cycle.
First, when you pull your chair up to a warm bowl of chicken noodle soup or you get your favorite birthday cake made by a relative, it means more than just any old meal. Our associations with food are closely linked to our memories.
And whether it's time spent with families and friends, recipes passed on from relatives can hold a special place in our hearts.
We want to hear from you. What recipes, what meals, what foods make you nostalgic or maybe even homesick? What's a cherished food memory from your childhood? Maybe one you've recreated? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or leave your comment, share your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page.
Joining us now on this Food Friday to talk about the foods, the recipes, the dishes that make us nostalgic is Kathleen Flynn. She's a New York Times bestselling author and food writer, and she recently wrote the book Burnt Toast Makes You Sing Good, a memoir with recipes from an American family. And Kathleen, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thank you for having me.
What got you thinking about this link between memories and feelings and food?
Well, I actually have written two other books, and one was about, you know, kind of going and following my lifelong dream to go study French cuisine in Paris at Le Cordon Bleu. And in that book, it was surprising to me in writing about my experience of studying cuisine in Paris that I kept coming back to the foods of my childhood and all these experiences of foods. And so, you know, I ended up including a lot of stories about, like, the chickens my parents raised and the pies my mom made and her chicken and, you know, fried chicken, stuff like that. And in my second book, the same stories crept in. And so I decided to just dedicate the third book to really kind of taking a look at that. I think that Midwest cuisine, it kind of gets a bad rap. I mean, I think that there's sort of this idea that it's all green bean casserole. And in fact, there is an extraordinary culinary tapestry that we have in the Midwest. You know, think of all the different immigrants who settled here. I mean, just in my own history, I have Swedish, German, Welsh, Irish, English, and some Italian woman snuck in there in the somewhere. And so, you know, and so to me, I really wanted to talk about my history, but I think by doing that, to shine a spotlight on how much great food there is. And also to, you know, as you said in the open, I think to really establish sort of this kind of trip sort of down memory lane, but tied really to a bunch of very specific recipes.
What do you think it is about food that makes it stand out so prominently in our memories, maybe of our childhood or a particular place or time in our lives?
I think that, you know, they say that smell actually is the number one trigger for memory. And, you know, when you first sit down to any food, you smell it first. And I think that smell and taste then, of course, are very tied together. And so I think that that's why we have these cravings that we do. Like when you're sick, you know, what do you want? Do you want your mom's soup? Do you want mashed potatoes like your grandmother made? I mean, I think that there's definitely something to that term of comfort food. I think that we're comforted by powerful, positive memories. And one of those things that are very tied to that are the foods that we eat and what we ate growing up. And foods are tied to very positive experiences. I mean, you may have had this extraordinary pasta dish. I can remember having this one, you know, linguine with clams, very simple dish on the island of Capri. And it haunts my dreams. Like, I still think about it. And I try to recreate it, and I can never do it because I will never be in that moment again. But it still is the thing that I go back to.
Yeah, that's part of it, don't you think? Food that you remember and is maybe has this aura of specialness around it or love, but you can never have it again. When you said mashed potatoes, I think about my grandmother's mashed potatoes, and they weren't fancy and they weren't done the way you're supposed to do mashed potatoes. And probably they were a little gluey, but I would love to eat them again with my grandmother, but I can't.
And I think that you brought up a great point. I think very often the way that we demonstrate love is through food and for cooking and nourishment. I mean, you know, you think about your grandmother, and the thing that she was doing in that situation was she was giving you something that she knew that you wanted, and it was something that she knew that would give you pleasure and joy. And that element, I mean, that you can taste that in a dish when someone makes something with love. And I think that's why, for instance, I don't know what Thanksgiving's like at your house, but in my house, you know, I can't try anything fancy. I mean, we have all the same recipes. We still have my grandmother's, like, stuffing, and we still butter this bag and put the turkey in. It's a nightmare, and we do it and whatever. But we have to, because that's what my family wants. They want this taste of another time. And it may not be a perfect taste, but it's definitely kind of brings us all back together. If I try to, you know, do something fancy, like I did a porcini mushroom stuffing, I was almost shunned from the herd. Like, not okay. So instead, you know, I tend to make a very, very traditional Thanksgiving. And I think that that's true throughout all kinds of cultures, and particularly around holidays. I mean, I have a friend who I'm taking cooking lessons with, and she's Muslim, and she makes these little date stuffed cookies called kleitcha, and she makes them exactly like her mother-in-law made them because that's what her husband wants. So it's really, I think it's so powerful that it expands geography, it spans class. I mean, I think that food is really the universal language, and a universal language that we can come back to.
We're talking to Kathleen Flynn. She's an author and food writer, talking about food, nostalgia, and memory, looking back at the foods that we remember, maybe from childhood, maybe from a time or place in our lives. You can call in at 800-642-1234. Is there a food that you remember, something you associate with a time in your life, maybe with a person? Is there a recipe that you make that was handed down through the generations in your family? 800-642-1234 is the number. We'll go to our callers now. Todd is on the line in Madison. Todd, hi.
Hi. Well, living in Racine 30, 40 years ago, they had the Pinocchio's, which there was a very, you know, drive up, they'd bring the food out to you. It was a little burger joint. It was great. Kind of similar to Kewpie's, which is still there. And on another similar note, you know, one thing I used to get all the time down there in Racine is I'd go to these bodegas and I'd pick up the swag. And granted, you got to pick out all the deeds and stuff.
All right, Todd, thanks for the call. So let's stay with Pinocchio's there, the memory of the scene, the atmosphere, the drive-up restaurant. So it doesn't necessarily have to be fancy food, Kathleen, but a particular memory.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm from Michigan, and you know, the whole Coney Island thing, you know, like for people who are not familiar, everybody listening to your show probably is, but you know, they're just hot dogs with chili, and but they're very specific. And in Flint, you know, it's Coco Vienna hot dogs, and it's a really specific sauce. And there's this debate on whether it should be dry or wet or whatever. In Detroit, it's wetter. And whenever I come back to Michigan, literally the first thing I go and I try to find is a really good Coney. And because to me as a kid, that was the big treat. I mean, it wasn't going to McDonald's. It was going to, you know, the original Coney place in Flint.
Well, thank you for the call. We're going to go next to Robert calling from De Pere. Robert, hi.
Hey, how you doing? Something that I really remember and it's very nostalgic is my Aunt Ethel's fried chicken. And we used to go down to Southern Indiana, where my dad's family is from, every year for a family reunion. And helping her make it for the family reunion, I remember the first time she asked if I'd grab her a tablespoon. So having to take home ec, and I was going through the drawer looking for a physical tablespoon, and she said, no, a tablespoon. And she reached in the drawer and grabbed a big old honking spoon. And I'm like, okay, this recipe's not going to turn out at all, but you know what? Every time, delicious, and everybody wants more, and we'd eat, and then Aunt Ethel would say, okay, what do y'all want for supper? And we'd be like, what?
No one was hungry by that point.
Yeah.
Well, that sounds like a great memory. And fried chicken, that is kind of one of those family ones, and it is a labor of love. It's a little more involved anytime you've got a deep fryer as part of the picture. But Robert's story, what does that bring up for you, Kathleen?
Well, we have a fried chicken in my family, too. I think everybody seems like they have one. It's another one of those universal recipes. My Uncle Clarence actually had went out to California with my parents when they were very young in their 20s. They're Irish primarily, but they started an Italian restaurant, which was a really poor idea. And they had four kids under five, and they took all their savings. It closed in 6 months. But one of the best things that came out of that whole experience was that my Uncle Clarence came out from Michigan to work in their restaurant, and he came up with this amazing fried chicken, and they fried it in the fryer there, but it had cornflakes. It was cornflakes and paprika and poultry seasoning, and even though they were a pizza and like pasta restaurant, they did it as a special, and it was so popular they had it on the menu all the time. And then the only sole review that they ever got on their restaurant talked about the chicken, talked about this fried chicken, even though they're a pizza place. So my mom always made that growing up. She never fried it, you know, because the whole messy thing and whatever, but she started to oven fry it, which sounds healthier until you read the recipe, which is essentially she would go and take a whole, like, you know, huge cup of margarine and pour it all over the whole top, you know, just to make sure that it was kind of similar to fried chicken. Wildly unhealthy, but delicious. I included that actually in my most recent book, and it's great.
And you shared that with us. We've got that up at the Central Time Facebook page. If people are going to splurge on some margarine or butter or whatever they use, and I have some fried chicken.
We're talking to New York Times bestselling author and food writer Kathleen Flynn right now about the foods that make us nostalgic, the recipes maybe they could pass down from generation to generation, and what they mean to you, what they mean to your family. Kathleen is the author of Burnt Toast Makes Us Sing Good.
We want to hear from you. What foods remind you of home, hold a special place in your memories? Is there a food that makes you think back to childhood, a comfort food that you remember from back in the day, whatever that day was that you turn to when you need that kind of comfort? Is there a recipe that has gone like Uncle Clarence's chicken from one generation to the next? Call in now at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can post on the Central Time Facebook page or email talk@WPR.org.
And we'll pick up the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're continuing our conversation about food and nostalgia and memory, and we want to hear from you. Is there a family recipe that makes you think of home or a different time in your life or a loved one that evokes those memories of time spent with family and friends? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Kathleen Flynn is with us. She's a food writer. She most recently wrote the book A Burnt Toast Makes You Sing Good, a memoir with recipes from an American family.
And we'll take a caller now. We've got Bobby joining us in Lone Rock. Hi, Bobby.
Hey.
What is your memory?
My memory is my grandma. She used to make me ice creams with strawberries every year on my birthday.
So homemade ice cream with strawberries. Have you ever, do you have the recipe and do you still make it?
I actually don't have it anymore. I couldn't find it after she passed away.
Yeah, brings up an interesting point. Thank you so much for sharing that, Bobby. And he doesn't have the recipe, which makes me think about the value of writing stuff down. Do you think it's something that we should think about as we go through the generations, if there are those special foods, to try to be aware of them in the moment and write them down so we can pass them on?
Yes, absolutely. I actually teach food writing, and some of my best students are people who are older and who want to actually take those moments and you know, write stuff down. One of the things I found in researching this book was that all my grandmother's, the stuff I loved that my grandmother made, she never wrote down. She did it all from memory. And that's very common. I've heard from many people who try to catalog their family recipes. And, you know, when I got my grandmother's recipe box, I was so excited. I'm like, oh, I'm going to get all this stuff. And instead, she just had the stuff like that she'd clipped out of magazines. I mean, she had sort of chicken chardonnay and whatever, stuff like that, that she never made, because those were the sort of her aspirational recipes at the time. But the stuff she made, like bread or chicken or mashed potatoes or, you know, even her stuffing, which I spent 6 months trying to recreate.
Wow.
She just made that from memory, and I think that's very common. One thing I recommend to people is that I think especially, you know, say for grandparents and grandchildren to cook together and to have the grandchildren, you know, really ask questions. And, you know, every kid's got a phone and, you know, record them and maybe even videotape them cooking together and watching the steps, because that way you can actually preserve that. It is surprising to me how often I hear from people who say, wow, I'm really trying to find, you know, this chicken and biscuits, and I thought we'd have this recipe, and I can't find it, and how do I replicate it? And it's sad when those recipes are gone.
Bobby, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go next to Rita in Rice Lake. Rita, hi.
Hi. My recipe is from my grandmother. It is a graham cracker pie, which has graham cracker crust, homemade pudding, meringue top, and then you sprinkle some of the crumbs on top of the meringue.
Well, I'm sold, Rita. Do you still make this?
My grandmother made it, my mother made it, my sister made it, and now we're passing it on to our son who lives in San Francisco. And for Christmas, he and I have made that the last few years, and it's just a joyous thing to do together and lots of memories. One thing that you were mentioning about maintaining these recipes, one thing that a friend of mine has done is framed her mother's or grandmother's favorite recipe.
Nice.
And that's something that I am going to do for this next Christmas.
Rita, thank you so much. So Kathleen, both of the things you just said, they did write it down and went beyond that and framed it, and multi-generational cooking going on. She and her son cooked this together.
Fantastic. I mean, and also, I'm going to tell you, I want that dish. That sounds awesome.
Sounds really good.
and I love that. I love the idea of framing it. I mean, I think, you know, that's a terrific gift. And I think even for someone who, say, wants to pass down a recipe, what a great way to share that and to really show, like, that value. I mean, you know, we frame the things that are important to us. We frame photos of great moments and memories and diplomas and all kinds of other stuff. I mean, why not frame a beloved recipe? I just think that's wonderful.
And I suppose the original recipes, at least if you cook like I cook, there's going to be like glops of butter on it and pieces of corn, and you can sort of see that on the recipe card. But I wonder about recipes now. I suppose that it's maybe online. There might never be that sort of living record on the recipe that you might have gotten in the past.
Yeah, that's interesting, actually. So in the cookbook world, they thought that, oh, no, ebooks are coming and you know, everything's going to be digital. And it's true. A lot of people do get their recipes off the internet. But, you know, people still love cookbooks. I mean, of all the book categories, that's really one of the things that people are not willing to give up. They want that physical book. They want to hold it. They want it on the kitchen counter. And I love it when people bring copies of my books. All my books have recipes in them. And there's, you know, splashes of wine and gravy and just stuff all over the recipe. And every food writer I know feels that way. In fact, I saw Julia Child sign someone's book and she was like, oh, how delightful, you know, because that there was all this stuff all over the recipe. Clearly someone loved it and really used it. And, you know, that's just a wonderful thing.
We're talking to Kathleen Flynn. She's a food writer and author, talking about foods and recipes that make us nostalgic, that have cherished memories from our childhood or important places, times, people in our lives. Back to our callers now. Shanda is on the line in Green Bay. Shanda, hi.
Hi.
What's your recipe for us?
Well, I grew up in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and my Finnish family up there brought a recipe from Finland for pasties when they came over on the boat. Yeah, so that is the recipe, really, the tried and true recipe that we make at home as a family, and it's a day-long undertaking at least to make the sheer amount that we need to feed everybody. That's the aroma triggers the memories, and, you know, it's one of those recipes that is really near and dear to us.
Shanda, thanks so much. I'm a troll from the Lower Peninsula, under the bridge, and I grew up loving pasties from trips to the UP. We didn't make them in my family, but they make me nostalgic, too. I bet there's a lot of those regional and ethnic recipes, Kathleen, that people have that attachment to.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I mentioned earlier the Coney Island. You know, my husband didn't know what I was talking about. He thought it was
me, too. I love those.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, too, you know, one of the things that I think really helps determine sort of regional dishes is, you know, what is there a bounty of? I mean, in Michigan, there are a lot of apples. I'm sure that a lot of, and you know, Wisconsin also, I mean, there are a lot of apples. And so you end up having a lot of recipes featuring those kinds of things. Like in my family, my mom made this apple crisp, delicious, had oatmeal and apples and nutmeg and cinnamon. And I can still remember the smell of that apple crisp baking in our farmhouse when I was like 5 or 6 years old. I mean, it was just a tiny kid. And once in a while, I still make that. You know, just it's one of my go-to dishes.
And we have that recipe shared from you, Kathleen, up on the Central Time Facebook page. And let's go next to Cindy, joining us in Fort Atkinson. Hi, Cindy.
Hi.
What is your food memory?
My greatest memory is when my grandmother, my mom's mom, lived with us when I was like in middle school, early high school, and of course, in Wisconsin, the winters are always very, very cold. And my grandmother loved to make cinnamon rolls. And when we would get off the school bus on those cold days, by the time we got to the porch, we could smell the cinnamon rolls.
Wow.
And it was always just a wonderful treat when we would come home from school have hot cinnamon rolls with butter melted on top.
Oh, what a fantastic memory.
Smell the cinnamon rolls when I think of it.
Do you still make them, Cindy?
I personally have not tried to make them myself, but I do have her original recipe. And after listening to the program, it's just kind of renewed my motivation to try and make them myself.
Well, good luck with that. Well, that's a beautiful memory. The smell, again, Kathleen, you were talking about the smell of the food triggering the memory. And that's the way for Cindy, you know, warm cinnamon bread, cinnamon rolls on a snowy day is the perfect vision of that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, you know, my grandmother made a great cinnamon roll also. And my mother, it was such an elaborate recipe. I understand why she probably hasn't made them often because it took to risings, all this stuff. But my mother would only make them on our birthdays. So it was they didn't have much money when we were growing up, but each of us got to pick our birthday dinner. And I have a whole chapter about that in the book. And each, you know, every year we'd always end up ordering the same thing. And really today, my birthday dinner would probably be the same thing I had when I was 8.
Kathleen, thank you so much. It's been a lot of fun.
Great. Thank you so much for having me. I've had a great time.
That's Kathleen Flynn. She's a best-selling food writer and author. Her most recent book is Burnt Toast Makes Us Sing Good, a memoir with recipes from an American family. She joined us to talk about foods that make us nostalgic. You can keep sharing your favorite cherished food memories. Maybe you've got a story about a recipe from your family from the past that's been handed down, or that you wish was handed down. You can share that story with us and find recipes for Uncle Clarence's fried chicken on the Central Time Facebook page.
The Wisconsin State Fair is coming up fast. It starts on August 4th. And to get you in the right frame of mind, On Tap from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel is giving a sneak peek of 10 new foods that are going to be featured at this year's State Fair. And the picture with the article kind of snagged me right away. It looks delicious.
Yeah, you share this with me. I tried to grab it off the screen and eat it, but I'll have to wait. Root beer float cake. It's a Sprecher root beer infused cake. Pretty good so far. Topped with meringue, filled with root beer infused cream. I would eat this. I also thought the deep fried old fashioned was worth a try. So it's like the cocktail, but they found foods with similar flavors. I have some doubts, but I'd try it once anyway.
Those two sounded really good. And I have to say, the root beer one looks like it's a mug in itself.
Right.
And they had a slice of it cut in half. This is on the Central Time Facebook page, by the way, if you want to see a picture. And the cream goes all the way through the cake part. It looks great. But we do disagree about one of the things. The deep fried olives with cream cheese. To me, sound great.
On a hot summer August day, this sounds like a little too much, like the salt and the oil. I love olives. I think deep frying would probably be great. Maybe too much. Also, the 50-yarder on a stick, a football-shaped cookie ice cream sandwich with cake batter cookie dough in the middle.
Served and on a stick.
On a stick at State Fair. Healthy food at the State Fair here on Central Time on the Ideas Network.